Have you ever found yourself standing before a building that seemed to speak directly to your soul? This is the essence of Howard Roark's architecture in Ayn Rand's masterpiece, The Fountainhead. Published in 1943, after years of rejection by publishers, this philosophical novel has become a cultural touchstone, selling over 6.5 million copies and inspiring generations of readers. Steve Jobs cited it as a formative influence, while figures from Vince Vaughn to Mark Cuban have praised its powerful individualist message. Beyond its popularity, the novel sparked fierce debates about the nature of creativity, individualism, and integrity in modern society. Its controversial themes continue to resonate in our age of conformity and groupthink, asking us, what price are we willing to pay to maintain our creative vision in a world that demands compromise? Howard Roark stands naked at the edge of a cliff, completely at ease with himself and the natural world. This opening image perfectly captures the essence of Rand's protagonist, a man utterly comfortable in his own skin, unconcerned with social conventions, and connected to the physical world in a profound way. The stark simplicity of this scene establishes Roark's fundamental nature. He exists in perfect harmony with reality, requiring neither artifice nor approval. When we first meet him, Roark has just been expelled from architecture school for refusing to design buildings in the classical styles his professors demand. His designs, stark, innovative, and fundamentally modern, represent a complete rejection of historical mimicry. The dean offers him a chance to return after a year if he'll conform, but Roark calmly refuses. "I don't intend to build in order to have clients. I intend to have clients in order to build." This exchange reveals not just stubbornness, but a fundamental philosophical stance about the relationship between creator and society. This statement encapsulates Roark's philosophy. Architecture isn't a service industry, but a creative endeavor with its own integrity. He believes each building should express its purpose through its structure, that what can be done with one substance must never be done with another, and that a building should be alive, like a man. His designs reflect this philosophy. Glass and steel are used honestly as glass and steel, never disguised to imitate stone or wood. When his friend Peter Keating asks for advice about his own career path, Roark responds with the question that drives the entire novel. Why do you ask others about your own work? Don't you know what you want? Roark's approach to architecture reflects his approach to life. He refuses to subordinate his vision to others' expectations or to historical precedent. While the architectural establishment worships the past, copying Greek temples and Renaissance palaces for modern buildings, Roark designs structures that express their function and materials honestly. His Monadnock Valley Resort, for instance, grows organically from its rocky site, incorporating natural granite into its design rather than imposing an artificial classical facade. This integrity extends beyond his professional life to his personal relationships. He forms connections only with those who recognize his value on his terms, never compromising his principles for social acceptance or professional advancement. What makes Roark's philosophy so compelling is that it isn't merely theoretical. We see it tested repeatedly throughout the novel as he faces poverty, public ridicule, and professional ostracism rather than compromise his vision. He works in a granite quarry rather than design buildings that violate his principles. When commissioned to design the Stoddard Temple, he creates a masterpiece of modernist architecture, knowing it might cost him his reputation. His unwavering commitment to his principles ultimately proves not just morally superior, but practically successful as well, as demonstrated by the eventual recognition of his genius and the triumph of his architectural vision. Through Roark, Rand illustrates that integrity isn't just a moral virtue, it's a practical necessity for anyone who wishes to live as a creator rather than a second-hander. If Howard Roark represents the ideal of the independent creator, Peter Keating embodies the tragedy of the second-hander, someone who lives through others' opinions rather than his own judgment. Handsome, charming, and technically skilled, Keating rises quickly in the architectural profession by pleasing the right people and following conventions. Unlike Rourke, who refuses the Paris Prize to work for his hero Henry Cameron, Keating accepts a position at the prestigious firm Franken & Hire, where he quickly becomes Guy Francon's favorite. Keating's rise is a masterclass in social manipulation. He systematically undermines colleagues like Tim Davis and Claude Stengel, taking credit for their work while maneuvering them out of the firm. When faced with design challenges beyond his abilities, he secretly seeks Rourke's help, then presents the work as his own. His crowning achievement, winning the Cosmo Slotnick building competition, is actually Rourke's design, which Keating copied after Rourke corrected his rotten plans. The tragedy of Keating lies in his moments of self-awareness. When alone with his fiancée Catherine Halsey, he admits Francon is an old fool and a pompous fraud, showing he can recognize mediocrity. Yet he continues to seek Francon's approval and emulate his approach. After winning the Cosmo Slotnick competition, Keating experiences not just triumph, but a dark, nameless feeling when people praise the building's brilliant skill and simplicity, qualities he knows came from Rourke, not himself. As the novel progresses, Keating's dependence on others' opinions destroys his potential for happiness. He abandons Catherine, whom he genuinely loves, to pursue Dominique Francon for her social connections. Later, when his career falters, he pathetically seeks validation from the very people who are replacing him, asking, "We're friends, aren't we friends?" His final degradation comes when he begs Rourke to design Cortland homes for him, admitting his own inadequacy. "Howard, I'm a parasite. I've been a parasite all my life." Keating's journey illustrates the soul-destroying consequences of living through others rather than developing one's own standards and abilities. By the novel's end, he has achieved external success, but lost his self-respect, artistic potential, and capacity for happiness. A cautionary tale about the price of conformity. Perhaps the most complex character in The Fountainhead is Dominique Francon, whose paradoxical actions stem from a unique philosophical premise, that greatness cannot survive in a mediocre world. Beautiful, brilliant, and fiercely independent, Dominique recognizes Rourke's genius immediately, but believes the world will inevitably destroy him. Her response is to try to destroy him herself as an act of mercy. When we first meet Dominique, she's writing a newspaper column that deliberately mocks things she actually admires. She explains to Alva Scarrett that she doesn't want to be tied to anything I like, preferring freedom to ask nothing, expect nothing, depend on nothing. This detachment protects her from a world she sees as fundamentally corrupt and unworthy. Dominique's perspective shifts dramatically after she encounters Rourke working in her father's granite quarry. Their first meeting crackles with tension as she watches him breaking stone, drawn to his strength and independence. Their subsequent sexual encounter, portrayed as a violent taking that she secretly desires, establishes the complex dynamic that will define their relationship. For Dominique, submission to Rourke represents the only form of surrender she can accept, precisely because his strength matches her own. After discovering Rourke is an architect, Dominique embarks on a campaign to destroy his career, preventing him from getting commissions while simultaneously praising his buildings in ways designed to turn public opinion against them. She writes that the Enright House should be dynamited rather than allowed to stand in a world unworthy of it. This apparent contradiction makes sense within her philosophy. She believes Rourke's buildings are too perfect for a corrupt world, and destroying them would be kinder than letting them be degraded by ordinary use. Dominique's self-destructive choices, marrying first Keating, then Winand, both men she doesn't love, represent her attempt to punish herself for loving Rourke in a world she believes will crush him. She tells Rourke explicitly, "I've done everything to escape from you, and you've done everything to bring me back. You've forced me to come to you." her journey toward accepting that greatness can survive and flourish even in an imperfect world parallels the novel's larger philosophical argument about the ultimate triumph of individualism over collectivism. The basic principle of collectivism is self-sacrifice, the sacrifice of the creator to the non-creator, of the able to the unable, of the successful to the unsuccessful. This is the hidden philosophy of Ellsworth Tui, the novel's primary antagonist and one of literature's most chilling villains. Outwardly a humanitarian architecture critic who champions the common man, Tui secretly works to destroy individual excellence and promote mediocrity. Tui's methods reveal Rand's understanding of how collectivist ideologies operate. He doesn't attack greatness directly, but undermines it through subtle manipulation of language and values. His architecture book, Sermons in Stone, argues that great buildings aren't created by individual geniuses, but are merely a condensation of the spirit of a people, denying the role of individual creativity. He forms councils and organizations filled with second-rate talents, promoting them while ignoring true innovators like Rourke. What makes Tui truly terrifying is his self-awareness. Unlike many villains who believe they're doing good, Tui understands exactly what he's doing and why. He tells his niece Catherine that she must stop wanting anything and kill the ego to achieve happiness. Later, he explicitly reveals his methods to Peter Keating. "I've never had any desire to be loved. I want to be obeyed." He explains that he promoted Keating precisely because he was replaceable, to protect the field from men who would become irreplaceable. Tui's ultimate goal is power, not over people's bodies, but over their souls. He explains his strategy as unite and rule, rather than divide and conquer, creating a society where independent thought is impossible, because people have been conditioned to value conformity above all else. His most revealing statement comes when he describes how to destroy society. "Don't set out to raise all shrines. You'll frighten men. Enshrine mediocrity, and the shrines are raised." Through Tui, Rand explores how collectivist ideologies gain power not through direct force, but by corrupting language and values until independence becomes morally suspect and conformity becomes virtue. His character serves as a warning about intellectual manipulators who use altruism as a mask for the will to power. Gail Winand embodies one of the novel's most complex and tragic figures, a man of extraordinary potential who chose the path of power over principle. Rising from the brutal poverty of Hell's Kitchen to become New York's most influential newspaper publisher, Winand's journey represents both the American dream and its corruption. His ascent from newspaper boy to media mogul demonstrates remarkable intelligence and determination, yet his methods reveal a profound moral compromise that ultimately proves his undoing. The New York Banner, Winand's flagship publication, exemplifies his cynical mastery of mass manipulation. He combines lurid sensationalism, manufactured outrage, and calculated sentimentality to achieve maximum circulation. His formula is brutally effective. Sex first, tears second. Make them itch and make them cry, and you've got them. The Banner specializes in character assassination, scandal-mongering, and emotional exploitation, all while maintaining a facade of moral crusading that Winand privately despises. What elevates Winand beyond a simple villain is his acute self-awareness and the private torment his success brings him. He maintains a luxury yacht where Winand publications are strictly forbidden, a floating sanctuary from his own corrupt empire. His private art collection, featuring works of uncompromising artistic integrity, stands in direct opposition to everything his newspapers champion. This duality reveals his deep understanding of quality and truth, making his public pandering to mediocrity all the more tragic. In his relationship with Dominique, Winand reveals the philosophical justification for his actions. "I've been a good businessman. I've made money. But that's not the purpose of a newspaper. Its purpose is power. He believes he can harness the mob's base instincts to achieve personal power while maintaining his private appreciation for excellence. This fundamental contradiction proves to be his fatal flaw. The Courtland trial becomes Wynan's moment of reckoning. When he attempts to use his media empire to defend Rourke, the first time he tries to align his public power with his private convictions, the facade crumbles. His staff rebels, his readership abandons him, and he faces the devastating realization that he doesn't control the mob controls him. The very power he spent his life accumulating proves worthless when tested. In his final, poignant confrontation with Rourke, Wynand articulates the bitter lesson of his life. One can't rule innocent men. The only power any government has is the power to crack down on criminals. When there aren't enough criminals, one makes them. One declares so many things to be a crime that it becomes impossible for men to live without breaking laws. This insight reveals how his pursuit of power led him to become an enabler of corruption rather than its master. Wynan's tragedy illustrates the futility of attempting to achieve power without purpose or principles. Despite amassing enormous wealth and influence, he ultimately destroys the only thing he truly values, his friendship with Rourke, because he built his empire on a fundamental contradiction. His character serves as a warning that power divorced from integrity becomes its own prison, and compromise, once embraced, demands ever greater sacrifices until nothing of value remains. The Fountainhead offers a profound exploration of the creative process through Rourke's approach to architecture. For Rourke, buildings aren't mere structures, but expressions of human consciousness and purpose. When designing the Heller House, he explains, "A house can have integrity, just like a person. Every piece of it is there because the house needs it and for no other reason." This philosophy manifests in every aspect of his work, from the initial sketches to the final construction details, where each element serves a specific function rather than mere decoration. Rourke's creative process begins not with historical precedents or client expectations, but with the building's purpose and site. He spends days studying the terrain, light patterns, and natural surroundings before putting pencil to paper. For the Monadnock Valley Resort, he designs houses that follow the natural contours of the landscape, creating structures that seem to grow organically from the earth, while maintaining mathematical precision. Each building responds to its specific location, some nestled into hillsides, others perched on ridges, yet all share a coherent visual language that speaks of both strength and harmony with nature. His Stoddard Temple exemplifies this approach, designed not to reach toward heaven, but to celebrate humanity's connection to Earth, a horizontal structure of gray limestone that honors the human spirit rather than religious dogma. The building's low profile, clean lines, and strategic use of natural light create spaces that inspire contemplation through their honest expression of materials and purpose rather than through ornate decoration or symbolic gestures. This approach contrasts sharply with the prevailing architectural methods represented by Keating and others, who begin by copying historical styles and then adapt them superficially to modern purposes. Keating's process involves studying architectural magazines, combining elements from different historical periods, and adding fashionable decorative elements without regard for their functional necessity. The novel portrays this as not merely aesthetically inferior, but morally wrong, a form of dishonesty in which buildings pretend to be what they are not. Through Rourke's work, Rand argues that true creativity isn't about self-expression in the narcissistic sense, but about solving problems according to objective reality. Rourke doesn't impose arbitrary designs, but discovers the form each building wants to be, a process that requires both rigorous logical thinking and profound aesthetic sensitivity. As he tells the jury during the Courtland trial, "The creator stands on his own judgment. The parasite follows the opinions of others. The creator thinks, the parasite copies. The creator produces, the parasite loots. This view of creativity extends beyond architecture to all human endeavors. Whether in engineering, art, business, or scientific research, Rand suggests that authentic creation always involves the same fundamental approach: identifying the essential nature of a problem and solving it through rational thought rather than imitation. The novel's enduring appeal lies partly in this vision of work as a noble activity through which humans express their highest potential, not through conformity or compromise, but through the honest expression of their rational understanding of reality. At its core, The Fountainhead dramatizes the conflict between individualism and collectivism, not just as political systems, but as fundamental approaches to human existence. This conflict plays out most explicitly in the courtroom scene, where Rourke defends his decision to dynamite Cortland Holmes after his design was altered. Rourke's defense isn't based on legal technicalities, but on the moral right of creators to the integrity of their work. He tells the jury, "The creator's concern is the conquest of nature. The parasite's concern is the conquest of men." This statement encapsulates the novel's central theme, that productive achievement directed toward mastering the physical world represents humanity's highest calling, while seeking power over other people leads to corruption. Throughout the novel, collectivism appears in various guises: architectural committees that dilute individual vision, newspaper campaigns that manipulate public opinion, and social pressure that punishes nonconformity. Against these forces stands Rourke, who refuses to participate in group projects or design by committee. When invited to join seven other architects to design a World's Fair, he declines, stating he would only work alone. Rand portrays collectivism not merely as inefficient, but as morally wrong because it subordinates individual judgment to group consensus. Through Tuohy's machinations, she suggests that collectivist ideologies gain power by making people feel guilty about their own abilities and achievements. Tuohy tells Catherine that her unhappiness comes from caring about her own virtue, advising her to stop wanting anything and kill the ego. The novel's climax comes when Rourke dynamites Cortland Holmes rather than allow his design to be corrupted, an action Rand presents as morally justified because creators have the right to protect their work from distortion. His subsequent acquittal represents the novel's philosophical resolution, the recognition that individual rights, including intellectual property rights, are paramount. This individualist message resonated powerfully in post-war America and continues to attract readers who feel stifled by conformist pressures. While critics have sometimes dismissed Rand's philosophy as simplistic, The Fountainhead presents a nuanced exploration of how individuals can maintain their integrity in a society that increasingly values consensus over independent thought. Nearly 8 decades after its publication, The Fountainhead continues to inspire readers with its vision of uncompromising integrity in a world that rewards conformity. Its enduring appeal lies not just in its philosophical arguments, but in its portrayal of characters who embody different responses to the central question: how should one live in a society that often punishes excellence and rewards mediocrity? The novel's exploration of architectural integrity has influenced generations of architects and designers. Frank Lloyd Wright, though initially dismissive, later acknowledged similarities between his philosophy and Rourke's approach. More broadly, the book has shaped conversations about creative ownership and intellectual property rights, anticipating contemporary debates about artistic integrity in commercial contexts. Beyond architecture, The Fountainhead has become a touchstone for entrepreneurs and innovators who see parallels between Rourke's struggles and their own experiences challenging established systems. Steve Jobs cited it as an influence, and its emphasis on vision over consensus resonates with many in the tech industry who value disruption over tradition. the novel's psychological insights remain equally relevant. Its portrayal of Keating's second-handedness, living through others' opinions rather than developing his own standards, speaks to anyone who has felt the pressure to conform to social expectations at the expense of personal fulfillment. Similarly, Dominique's journey from self-destructive cynicism to acceptance that greatness can survive in an imperfect world offers hope to those who struggle with idealism in compromised circumststances. Even the novel's critics acknowledge its power to provoke thought and challenge assumptions. Its uncompromising stance against collectivism continues to spark debate about the proper relationship between individual rights and social responsibilities. While some readers embrace Rand's individualism wholeheartedly, others find value in wrestling with her ideas even when ultimately disagreeing with them. Perhaps the most significant legacy of The Fountainhead is its celebration of productive work as a noble activity. In an era increasingly dominated by virtual experiences and passive consumption, Rourke's passionate commitment to creating physical structures that serve human needs while expressing human potential reminds us that making things that last is one of life's most meaningful endeavors. As Rourke tells the jury, "The work, not the reward, is the measure of creation." This elevation of creative integrity over external validation remains the novel's most powerful and enduring message.